This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Dr. Jody Hyman learned about medicine at Harvard Medical School. But right after she graduated, she learned something medical school hadn't taught her: how confused and helpless patients often feel. She learned this the hard way by becoming a patient. It was just after graduation that she had a seizure in the middle of the night. The seizure was caused by a blood vessel that broke and caused her to bleed into her brain. That led to brain surgery, paralyzing pain, hallucinations, and months of slow recuperation. She's recovered now and teaches courses at Harvard Medical School on the patient-doctor relationship and healthcare policy. She's written a new memoir about her experiences as patient and doctor called Equal Partners. Her first bad experience as a patient happened the night of her first seizure, when the ambulance came and the paramedics assumed she was a drug addict.
As is common after generalized seizures, I was confused. I didn't know what was going on, but my husband was quite aware. He's a physician. He told the ambulance drivers, "I'm a physician. She had a seizure. We need this kind of medication." And he was treated like I was a drug addict. He asked what kind of drugs are you taking? He said, "None." They kept repeatedly asking him and wouldn't believe that I wasn't taking drugs. And all the way to the hospital, really ignored his requests for medical help based on his medical knowledge of the situation.
So how did their assumption that you were taking drugs affect the care that you were given that night?
Well, I think one of the important ways it affected is no one explained to me what was going on, so I was terribly confused. As far as I was concerned, strangers were coming and taking me out of my bed. I had no idea what had happened, and taking me to a foreign place, roped down my arms and legs, and no one bothered to say the simple words that really would have helped a great deal. You had a seizure. We're here with an ambulance. We're here to help you.
Do you have any idea what caused you to bleed into your brain?
Yeah, what I had was a cavernous hemangioma, which is just a set of abnormal blood vessels, and we don't really know much as physicians about why they tend to bleed when someone enters their late 20s or early 30s, but that's a common time for them to bleed.
Your doctor recommended surgery, and you had to decide whether to have it or not. You write that your father tried to help you decide because, after all, he teaches methods of rational decision-making to graduate students. So with his help guiding you through rational decision-making, did you have enough information to make what qualifies as a rational decision about having surgery?
No, it really was dramatic, both to my father and I. He had taught decision-making in the past, and I had taken decision-making courses. Of course, in all those courses, we deal as if we have certain knowledge. So we say, what are the chances of different things happening? What are the benefits? What are the risks of surgery? But in fact, the surgeons really had very little idea about all of those. We got three different opinions, and all three surgeons, although they all recommended the surgery and felt quite strongly it was important, they all had different beliefs about what would be the outcome and what would be the benefits.
What were you told would happen with the surgery as opposed to what actually happened?
I was told it lasts about an hour and a half and that it would be simple to find the hemangioma because it was on the surface of my brain. In fact, it took them 10 hours, and at the end they weren't sure whether they'd gotten it or not. That was the first thing. The second is that I was told by two out of the three surgeons that it would decrease the chance of seizures, and in fact, I continued to have seizures afterwards. To their credit, they were all giving me the information to their best of their knowledge, and I think the most we can ask of physicians is that they share with us their level of uncertainty.
You had a lot of side effects that you were unprepared for after your surgery.
I did. I think I was unprepared for how they would handle the pain after the surgery. It's a tremendous amount of pain, and it was inadequately managed. That's something that's commonly a problem in our healthcare system. I was given medications too widely apart for them to work. My husband, a physician, tried to get one of the nurses to contact a physician so that I could have more frequent doses of medication, but she was unwilling. And unfortunately, this is a tragedy that's repeated frequently in our healthcare system, that people don't get pain medication in a way that's effective. The second thing that's happened that's described in the book is hallucinations, which I had. No one had warned me about the possibility of hallucinations afterwards, but worse yet, when I asked physicians what these were and how long they would last, what they were caused by, I was told that nobody had any idea. That in itself was just terrifying because it meant that I had no idea whether I'd gone crazy. Later on, patients told me that, in fact, these were very common. And that left me to surmise that if the physicians had been talking to patients, listening to their experiences, then they would be able to know and to share with other patients, this is common, this won't last forever.
You had a pretty horrendous experience with your surgery. It took 10 hours as opposed to the 90 minutes you were told to expect. You had terrible side effects that you were unprepared for. And that, you know, that the doctors did not predict were going to happen. And then, to make matters worse, you were told, well, you're probably going to have a second operation because we missed some of the hemangioma. You sought a second opinion, and the second doctor said, you don't need it. You don't need the surgery. In fact, there's no more hemangioma left.
Yeah, it was really just chance in some respect that we got a second opinion. I had been ready to go ahead for the second surgery and then got profoundly ill in the hospital. I was having brain swelling that led to constant vomiting. There was a medication I'd been given intravenously to take care of the brain swelling. They then stopped the medication and gave it to me by mouth, but because I was vomiting every 1 to 5 minutes, I couldn't keep the medicine down. I spent hours trying to convince the resident on call to do what really should have been routine care, which is put me back on a medication intravenously that would work. In the end, I had to get my husband, a physician, in after 12 hours to intervene and get me the medication that worked and immediately took care of the brain swelling and the aseptic meningitis. That whole episode made us rethink diving ahead. And that's when we went to get a second opinion. Had that not happened, I probably would have had a second needless operation.
Dr. Jody Hyman is my guest, and she's the author of a new book called Equal Partners. And the book is a memoir about the period right after she graduated from Harvard Medical School, when she bled into her brain and had surgery and a long period of recovery afterwards. She now teaches at Harvard Medical School. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Dr. Jody Hyman, and her new memoir, Equal Partners, is about the practice of medicine and about her experiences as a patient after she bled into her brain and had a very serious brain operation. Your book is called Equal Partners, and you use that title because you think patient and doctor should be equal partners when there is an illness. In what sense should they be equal partners?
Well, I think physicians make a big mistake by assuming that because they know more microbiology or they know more anatomy than patients, that they know much more and that they can't be equal partners. In fact, patients know far more about what it's like to live with an illness, what the symptoms are like, what they need in terms of balancing their life goals with dealing with the symptoms they have from their illness, what they need in terms of treatment. So really the two bring complementary but different things to what should be an equal partnership in decision making.
Were you often given the status of equal partner in your relationship with your doctors when you were sick?
Well, the book describes what happened to me and what happens to a number of other patients, and in fact, although sometimes we are treated as equal partners, and certainly there are wonderful physicians providing care that way, all too often, in my case and in that of other patients, symptoms we had were not believed or we were not incorporated in our own care.
Did you have symptoms that you felt were overlooked?
The spring before I had the brain surgery, I had had increasingly severe headaches and had called a physician about the headaches. I was told that they were probably stress. And as the headaches got worse, I called back again and was told again stress. And I said, well, I do lead a stressed life, but I don't think it's any more stress this year than any other year. And was just told, well, again, don't worry about it. you have children, you're in medical school, it's probably just stress. I think that that kind of disbelieving or undervaluing patients' symptoms is very frequent and frequently leads to problems.
You know, hearing you talk about what you were up against when you were sick, everybody else must be wondering, well, what are their chances of really understanding what's happening? Because you, after all, had just gotten out of Harvard Medical School. So when you talk about being an equal partner with your doctor, you were much more equipped to be afforded that position than someone who didn't have medical training.
I was, but nonetheless, my voice was often ignored, as in the case I described where I had the constant vomiting. It really didn't matter that I was a physician. When I was in medical school, I had heard a story about a patient who was in a New York hospital emergency room with a heart attack, tried to be seen, telling him how seriously sick he was, couldn't be seen for hours, and in the end called an ambulance to the emergency room to take him to another hospital. At the time I heard this story, I thought it was apocryphal. I couldn't believe it happened. And after my experiences, seeing what's like, how you're treated, whether you are a physician yourself or whether you're a patient who's not a physician, I realized that often it's like talking underwater. You can speak as long as you want, but nobody's listening and no one can hear.
How do you think your work as a doctor was changed by your experiences as a patient?
When I went back to be a resident after this episode, my work was really dramatically changed in a number of ways. I think the first way is, while I had always believed patients' experience, it threw even more weight on the side of believing patients' experiences. Just to give one example, I took care of a child who had terrible neck pain, disabling enough that she was missing more and more school. She'd been seen for several years, and more doctors disbelieved her because they couldn't find the problem. And I think because of my experiences, I understood that when we can't find problems as physicians, it doesn't mean they're not there. I got her into further diagnostic workup. We examined her, and in fact, she had a problem with her cervical spine. Other ways in which it changed were just understanding the importance of families in the care and what the impact is on families. The book tells the experiences of my families and some other patients' families, but clearly it's a dramatic life event to go through, having a loved one that's sick. And as in my recuperation, for many people, our families play a vital role. So when a patient I took care of had meningitis, I spent a lot of time up at night talking to her family, reassuring her family, being as honest as I could about what we knew and answering their questions. Again, I'm sure I would have done that before, but the weight I placed on involving the family was different.
For a physician who is really dedicated, and they follow the same philosophy you did, that the patient and doctor should be equal partners, a lot of time should be spent in discussing symptoms, discussing reactions to medicine, are there barriers that prevent a doctor from actually doing it?
There are two major barriers that prevent doctors from doing it. One is the problem of time, and that comes in every aspect. It comes in that patients are discharged sooner from the hospital when they're sicker. Insurers often don't let physicians follow up with those patients. When they're on an outpatient basis, as we've discussed, the appointments are far too short to discuss health issues. The second is that physicians often aren't given a choice as to what kind of treatments they can recommend. Insurers are playing an increasing role, limiting what choices the physician can recommend, and that in turn means the physician doesn't even offer the patient what are all the options. That's for the physician who's trying. Even more concerning for the patient is those physicians who this isn't a primary concern for them. Health insurers are increasingly using economic incentives that the physician's pay will be tied to whether or not they order an X-ray or order a lab test. And that just makes it less and less possible for patients to know that their physician will give them an honest, open-minded view of what the best options are.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Jody Hyman's new memoir is called Equal Partners. She teaches at Harvard Medical School. This is Fresh Air.